always, today you always have to use cosmology as an excuse to do type 1a supernova physics, so I'm not an exception. And I really don't want to talk about all the different aspects of physics, but really what constraints we get nowadays from observations to the physics of supernova. After a brief introduction, I want to go for explosion and Lyapunov spectral models, discuss different scenarios and their properties, and always we'll go from a more general part to some special questions, then go to some quantitative analysis, and then go for the application to cosmology in particular to ask whether we really can do and what we have to do if we want to do high-precision cosmology, which is a nice buzzword. Okay, so what do we observe in supernova? The first thing which we observe is the light curves, and here's a here's an overlay of 24 light curves, basically from the 92, where it was shown that all type 1As are the same. So you see rise times of about 19 to 20 days. Then you have a decline ratio and a long tail of which is powered by radioactive decay of nickel. And from this we know that we really produce about half a solar mass of nickel in this object. Now a lot of things have happened. The first thing was they are not all the same. In fact, they span a brightness range between minus 17 to about minus 20 this magnitude. Here are the data from the CTIO distances with absolute brightness. And what has turned out, that there seems to be a strong correlation between the brightness here, and I have to excuse myself, it's a magnitude, so that's brighter, that's dimmer, relatively to the decline rate. This means a change of the brightness from here to plus minus 50, plus 15 days in this case. And this you have the light curve shape methods, and well, it's all basically the same. And then you can draw a line between this and the subluminous supernova, and then you get very high accurate distance determinations. One question which certainly will occur is whether you really can draw a line or whether these are the same objects or like this ones, which are in the normal bright range. What you observe in the spectra are typical burning products of explosive carbon-oxygen burning under densities between 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 9 grams per cubic centimeter. So you see silicon, sulfur, iron, and so on. And you see expansion velocities, which corresponds in Doppler shift, roughly speaking, to expansion velocities at maximum light between 10 and 15,000 kilometers. And from all this, we really know that it's a thermonuclear explosion of the white dwarf. And just to help you a little bit of orientation, I want to finish with the final conclusions. This means type 1As are really thermonuclear explosions of classical white dwarfs. They appear relatively homogeneous, and what relative means we will come later on, because they are really determined by nuclear physics, which determines the structure of the white dwarf, which is completely degenerate and therefore hardly depends on temperature, and the explosion physics, because the explosion itself comes from nuclear burning. This means where we have basically the energy released if we change the elements. The total energy production in the explosion is really given by the amount of burning. This means how much do we burn from the white dwarf. And the light curves are completely powered by the radioactive decay of nickel. Simply, the initial stored energy goes into expansion, and we have a white dwarf from 1600 kilometers, which expands with 10,000 kilometers. So any initially stored energy goes is completely lost by adiabatic expansion, and really nickel powers the light curves. The main point is basically another really thing is, as we will see, the progenitor evolution and the explosion itself goes really through several phases of stellar amnesia, where we almost lose all the information. And the reason is they look relatively similar, simply because if you have a degenerate white dwarf, it doesn't really matter how you form it. It will have always similar, very similar structures. And only now, with this increased data, we are now in the situation that we really can ask some questions about progenitors. So what's important to take away is that the homogeneity doesn't imply that we really go for a unique scenario. We may have very different regimes which really follow to the similar things. And this becomes important if you assume that local and distant samples are, for instance, the same. Now, do we have some evidence that really they undergo evolution? The other thing what you can use is basically statistical properties. What you have here is the color at maximum light and the brightness at maximum light as a function of the position in the galaxy where they went off. What you see in the inner layers, where you see both young and old stars, you have a very widespread of bright colors and brightnesses, whereas in the outer layers, where star formation has mainly ceased for quite a while, they become more narrow, And this means on the time scale of a few hundred million years, they really show some evolution. This means dying out of certain kinds of progenitors. What this also means, this may or may be corrected by the brightness decline relation, as we will see. Now, first of all, why do we do models for supernova? First of all, it's fun, but more or less, we want to learn something about the nature of the supernova. What are really the progenitors? What are the explosion scenarios? How does the nuclear burning front really propagates through the white dwarf, and how does the ignition process works? And finally, we want to see whether they are really spherical or whether we have 3D signatures. This means, with this we hope to understand why are Type 1A robust as standard candles, and up to what level they are really robust, and do we understand the observed correlation, means the brightness decline relation. And so with this is certainly, is there one scenario for type 1A or do we see a variation? And for the distance determination, if you really can calculate these things relatively robust, you can determine the Hubble constant independently from the distance scale by delta CFEs. And you can really probe evolutionary effects. For instance, you can may ask, what does the change of the metallicity does for these objects? And how can really evolutionary effects with redshift be recognized, and maybe we can even correct them or not. Now, first coming to the scenario, they are white dwarfs are the final stellar evolution of stars with less than 8 solar mass stars, which basically go up to the helium burning only, form a carbon oxygen white dwarf, and then eject their envelope in a PN phase. Details are not well known. If they are really single stars, they just cool down and nothing happens. However, if they are a member of a binary system here, it may come to mass overflow. We have an accretion disk. We have accretion on the surface and surface burning. And the white dwarf may grow. So initially, a white dwarf of 1.6 to 1.2 solar masses, depending on the progenitor mass, may accrete and then may really come to the phase that we really go close to the Chandrasekhar mass. For the evolution, we don't really know whether the accretion is that's the red supergiant or main sequence star, which accretes hydrogen, whether it's a helium star, or whether we have basically disrupted white dwarf, which that accretes carbon oxygen rich material in nature. Really, all the things may be produced. However, if this object comes close to the Chandrasekhar mass, just by compressional heat, we heat up, and then carbon oxygen may ignite in the center, and we have a thermonuclear explosion, and just the things goes away. Alternatively, we may have two merging white dwarfs which merge on the hydrodynamical timescales. Now, if we want to detail, if we want to really get these hints on the progenitor, we have really to cook up a supernova. So, and here, first we have the bright star, bright things, this means the stellar evolution of stars with less than 7 solar masses over time scale, 10 to the 9 years are very well known. The uncertainty is a little bit the mass loss, but this gives you the initial structure of the white dwarf before it accretes. Then it's getting a little bit darker. Better we don't know very little about this phase. About 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 8 years, we have rapid accretion, we have surface burning, and this really gives may grow the white dwarf to the Chandrasekhar mass. And potential progenitors are, for instance, the supersoft X-ray sources. Then we go to the thermonuclear runaway, which really preconditions the evolutionary phase. Then we have a hydrodynamical phase of the explosion, which only lasts a few seconds, where we have nuclear synthesis, release of explosion energies. From this, we have then a rapidly expanding envelope. And just by geometrical dilution, we see deeper and deeper, and we release energy. So we have light, we need this time evolution, this means the light curves, and then we also want to have detailed spectra. Now, just to make sure why these things really have to be calculated as consistent as possible becomes clear if we look on the typical structure of a type 1A envelope at about maximum light. Here are the physical quantities as a function of distance, that's 10 to the 15, 2 times 10 to the 15 centimeters. The red lines here, the Thomson sphere, roughly speaking, at this phase. And this is basically the upper layers where the lines in the optical are formed and somewhere in between. First of all, what you see here, the gamma ray deposition, even at maximum light, to a good fraction, this means the hard radiation by the nuclear processes, really deposit energies in the photosphere, this means the directly observational part, to a large fraction. So you cannot assume the standard stellar atmospheres at this point. The other thing is that the densities here is between 10 to minus 12 to 10 to minus 16 particles per 15 particles per grams per cubic centimeter. This means we have low densities, or better, we don't cannot assume statistical equilibrium for the level population of atomic ones. We have really to solve the full number of E calculations and LTE things. The other thing which becomes clear, if we look for the optical depths here, it may go up to the optical depth of 30 in this phase and the radius of 10 to the 15. And then it's very easy. Tau squared times delta R divided by C is a time scale for energy diffusion from here out, which takes about 1 to 2 weeks. And this means it's the same time that the rise to hydrodynamical time scale to maximum light, which is 15, 16 days. And so basically the energy which we see at the photo coming out at maximum light, which comes from deeper layers, is formed much earlier, weeks earlier. So we have to have the time-dependent non-LTE problem in front of us. Okay, this means the problem is really we have to take this last step's light curve spectral explosions really very consistent. How do we do it? Now, that's basically the numerical code called HYDRA, hydrodynamical radiation transport, because it's really a code which heavily relies on accurate radiation transport. So we have different modules to let it parallelize. We have a hydrodynamical model that's 1D Lagrangian, spherical with a front tracking for the nuclear burning front, or 3D Cartesian Eulerian, which is basically based on PPM. Or we can assume free expansion at some later phase. On the left side, we have this nuclear reaction networks where we use Telemann's reaction library and have about 600 nuclei in our typical calculation with a high density equation of state for 10 to the 10 to up to 1 gram per cubic centimeter. At later times, the density drops, as you have seen, and we have a low energy equation of state, including the statistical equation for the level population and opacities. On the right-hand side, we have the transport equations, means the gamma ray transport 1 and 2D. Radiation transport is done with a variable Eddington tensor method in 1D spherical or 3D, where the Eddington tensor elements are calculated by a simple Rybicki scheme, means a differential scheme, or with the Monte Carlo scheme for 3D situations. Now coming back to the supernova, which we want to calculate. So just first the sketch. We have here a carbon-oxygen white dwarf close to the Chandrasekhar mass, which is ignited by the compressional heat.
Peter,
yes?
Is that just a coincidence that it's near the Chandrasekhar
mass? No. Basically, if you want to bring the temperature up, you now need you accrete material so the star becomes shrinking. So you need to increase the temperature to about 1.3 billion degrees to have explosive carbon burning. And because the material becomes more and more compressible close to the Chandrasekhar mass, this means you release more energy when you approach the Chandrasekhar mass before the conduction, the heat conduction and the turbulence can basically cool the white dwarf sufficiently well, and you only get a few hundred million degrees, so you wouldn't ignite. So only when the material in the center becomes very compressible, you really bring the temperature up. Or you would need a much higher accretion rate than you can allow if you have a tensor for solar mass, but then you cannot have burning at the surface. So you have two modes of this of this burning, which basically means how is this material ignited. If it's just ignited by pre-compression, then you have a so-called detonation front. The velocity is close to the speed of sound, and this just means the white dwarf cannot really pre-expand. Now the burning products or the temperatures which you can reach depends basically on the energy generation per cubic centimeter. This means on the density. If you go with if you have a detonation, the outer region cannot pre-expand because there's no information which goes out, and therefore you produce basically a nickel blob. From this we know that we need something like a slow burning front or a deflagration phase. In this front, you have energy conduction really transports the heat from the burned to the unburned region only at the per mil of the speed of sound. And this really gives you then this pre-expansion phase. The problem is this burning is unstable, and in principle, you have the increase of the surface by wiggling and by Rayleigh-Taylor's the instabilities. We come to this in the moment. So the speed can be a few tenths of a speed of sound or something like this order. Anyway, you have this pre-expansion, and then the density drops sufficiently well. And if you then accelerate the front, you may then not get temperatures only below 5 billion degrees. You produce only intermediate mass elements, silicon and sulfur, and the outer layers may even become unburned. Now, the problem, or the point is basically, it's really not how you come to this place, you come to this intermediate phase. And the merger may produce a very similar scenario here, because you have a hot merging white dwarf which also forms a hydrostatic intermediate hot dwarf, or during the progenitor evolution you may burn so much carbon oxygen which also gives you this intermediate state. So, and that's one of the questions where we really, so it's here we have some typical phase of amnesia. We don't really know from which path we come to this stage and then go to the burning in this case. Now, if we look on the real deflagration front, it's becoming a little bit more complicated, and that's a calculation by Alexei Kokhlov. And here we see the white dwarf after about 2.5 seconds in a 3D calculation, that's burned material, that's unburned material. What you see, you have here Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities as soon as you go a little bit out of the central region, because you have gravity versus acceleration, and you see not a well-defined structure, but unburned material up to the center. If you look on the velocity, though, it's really mainly this outer layers already expands to 10, 15,000 kilometers. The inner layers become more and more spherical already at 1.8 seconds. They are relatively spherical. After 3 seconds, they are completely spherical. So you basically lift the white dwarf in its potential, but you get this non-structured chemical structure. In deflagration models, the point is the outer layers can never be reached by deflagration front because the velocity is already in the order of the speed of sound. So as a characteristics, even in 3D, you always have a very wide layer of unburned material at top. And current calculation burn only about half the white dwarf, and the rest cannot be burned just by causality, basically. And this means you produce a nuclear energy of 0.8 to 1.1 10 to the 51 ergs. And because you have to overcome the binding energy of the white dwarf, the free expansion is only 3 to 6 times 10 to the 50 ergs, which corresponds to a mean velocity of only 4 to 5,000 kilometers, which is much lower than you observe. So what you need is basically a nonlinear phase of the explosion, or you have to trigger a detonation by some mechanism, which we come to in a minute. So the main point is if you trigger at this phase, which we actually need, a detonation, we don't really know where. Now then, these densities are sufficiently high to burn it away up to nickel. So you basically lose the signature, and again, the structure will become very much layered, and you will have here a nickel layer, a silicon layer, and an outer, almost very small unburned layer.
So can you tell us what physical conditions are necessary to trigger a detonation?
Yes. Next thing. Sorry. Yes. So the physical condition necessary in laboratory experiments, you often see this transition, but in most cases it seems to be a reflected shock from the walls, basically, as it means a boundary effect. And you have some boundaries in the white dwarf, in the chemical structure, but generally not so much. And we don't really know at the moment what is the reason, what is the real reason. Has become clear, simply the resolutions are not sufficient. The burning front thickness is only 10 to minus 4, 10 to minus 5 centimeters. The white dwarf has 10 to the third, so the resolution is really just lacking. So the people really can calculate the Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities. There has been several possible mechanisms. One is that you have a lot of shock, crossing shock waves due to the sound. That's suggested by Eli Livner. Another possible mechanism is the Seldovich mechanism. This means you mix burned and unburned mix thing on a microscopic scale, bring the temperature up, and therefore have sufficiently burning, increase the burning sufficiently much that you, that the precompression basically can let the detonation go. The mixing by Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities has been suggested by Alexei Kokhlov and Niemeyer and so on. One of the problem is it only works if the fluctuations in the background are relatively small. Because if you need basically a front which really pushes this. If you have too small elements which suddenly do it, you cannot really produce a compression because material can go sideways. Another thing which hasn't been considered yet really is that you have a white dwarf which is rapidly rotating because you accrete material. And there are shear instabilities, at least in the current calculations, between the accreted material and the former CO core. And the shear flow and the instabilities produce an external mixing basically to the front. And just imagine you have a burning front which goes into such a shear flow. This can suddenly build very wide sheets. This we have to do now in details, and we are working on this. It's not yet done, but that's another point which is external, which hasn't been observed. That's really a new kind of instabilities which may affect both the deflagration properties, this means the change, but it may also trigger a DDT. we will see. So that's not really filled. The other limitation in current models is that all these models assume that the white dwarf doesn't move when it goes on, off. This means it's a static white dwarf without any motion. And now the question was, where really does ignition occur? And the question was, does it really occur halfway through the white dwarf at 500 kilometer radius, or does it occur more central? What we did recently was attacking this problem a little bit in the first step. We followed the last 5 hours before the runaway. And what then happens, basically, we form here some bubbles, which basically are buoyancy driven and which can rise. And if during the rise, means during the adiabatic expansion, the nuclear rates or the heating overwhelms the adiabatic cooling, then you could get an ignition. And the classical picture was how you get very strong off-center ignition. Now, what happens in reality is a little bit more difficult. Basically, you have a lot of rising blobs over the course of a few hours. And what they basically do, they accelerate and they produce here some turbulent velocity fields, which are the order of the terminal velocity. Now, this really changes the way how you ignite, because if such a blob is found in an upward stream, it just cooled faster. Whereas if it's put in the downward stream, it may even be compressed. What we find, you find really an ignition, and this is not the entire white dwarf, these are only the inner 100 kilometers, means the 16th of the white dwarf shown, calculated as the entire white dwarf. But you basically have a pretty central ignition, and because the elements, the eddies, which have this larger, which are the largest, really have the best way to transport, also very likely you have only one point of the ignition at the time. From here to here, it's only at 1600th of a second before the ignition, and you have hundreds of this during the evolution, but at one point it really just happens. So, and these velocities are of the order of the initial buoyancy, even in the explosive phase. But this means also you already disrupt the deflagration front very early on, and this will change the deflagration velocities. Okay, let me go to some general characteristics that we are dealing with. So if we have Chandrasekhar mass model, classical detonation can be really ruled out. We don't see a pure nickel blob. If we have deflagrations, we have unburned CO layers at the very outer layers. Now, currently, it's half a solar mass, but even under France, this means if you assume you burn really much more in a nonlinear room, you never can reach these very outer layers, so you will stick with about 2/10 or 3/10 of a solar mass, even in the most optimistic outlook. You have large variation in the explosion energy because you may not burn the entire white dwarf, only parts, and it may depend on the initial condition how much you burn. And there is very little chemical layering because you have unburned material up to the center, so it means through the entire white dwarf and partially burned relatively far out. In delayed detonations, a characteristic of any detonation mode is basically that the burning products are layered like the density structure. And this means you have very little CO unburned left. You can go to the outer layers. You have small variations in the explosion energy because you almost burn everything. And you have a layered chemical structure. Mergers have a very similar layered structure because they start already with a detonation, but they should have some unburned CO layer in the outer layers, which comes from this accretion disk, which probably is not eaten up just when the thing goes off. It's very unlikely. Subchandrasekhar, I don't want to discuss. There was a model triggered by helium, but you would need high velocity nickel. Now, we have to go back a little bit to quantitative models where we assume what are the properties, and the question was, we see the properties, what would it take? And what we did is we calculated spherical models or perturbed models where the 3D effect is artificial or by hand imprinted. So we have as a free parameter the explosion of the white dwarf. This means the central density of the white dwarf, which mainly depends on the accretion rate. This means on the compression rate, at which time it can overwhelm the cooling. We have the chemical profile of the white dwarf, which comes from the stellar evolution calculations, and the description of the burning front. In the detonation phase, you can do it consistently. In deflagration phase, you have basically to assume from 3D calculations what are the wiggles, and so you produce an effective burning rate. White dwarf, you have this other part. It looks a little bit like a lot of assumptions, but what you really get out is a monochromatic light curve. This means the time evolution, the spectra including the time evolution, and for polarization, you see even then directional dependent luminosities. Just to show you such a model, here we have an initial main sequence star of 3 solar masses, which forms this 0.7 solar mass main sequence star. white dwarf accretes to the Chandrasekhar mass and then goes off. Here we have the density of this white dwarf, here is the time, here the snapshot is just 0.2 seconds, and that's the velocity here in 1,000 kilometers per second. On the right-hand plot, you see the chemistry. Red means NSE, this means burning up to nickel iron group elements. Green means incomplete burning, this means up to the silicon sulfur group, and blue means unburned material. In this case, this means that's the initial white dwarf structure.
Are these all non-rotating?
This is a non-rotating.
Are they expected to be rotating?
Yes.
Fast?
Yes. We come to this in a, right. Exactly. We come to this in a minute. We go from simple to more complicated. But you are right. So what we see here is that the time which runs. Okay, I missed the initial part, but it doesn't matter. Let's go, just go the second time through. What you see here initially, the white dwarf starts here. Deflagration front goes through, it basically lifts the white dwarf, and after about 7 seconds or 8 seconds, you almost have V is proportional R, so it's a linear expansion. Let's go. Here we go with the deflagration. We start already with this pre-expansion, and this time lasts between 3 and 7 or 8 seconds. Then we turn artificially by mixing artificially to a detonation, and then really disrupt this. What's here important is that the density just then goes down. This inner region of nickel is completely formed during the deflagration phase, and this we always would have. The transition to a detonation, which is a free parameter, a random parameter, if you like, really is responsible for this nickel production in the outer layers. And it's clear, as longer as you wait with the transition, as less you have this of this nickel production. If you look for the final chemistry here, with different transitions between 2.5 10 to the 7 and 8 times 10 to the 6 grams, you see you have a certain range here. The inner layers, you have always the same. Basically, the outer layers, you have different amounts of nickel, and between these models, now we have a factor of 5 in the nickel production, basically, therefore, which really then goes into the light curve. But also what's clear, you have here an inner region where you have electron capture, which mainly depends on the central density, therefore on the accretion rate, but basically you cannot avoid to produce some amount of nickel in the inner layers, and these models would predict a minimum luminosity of a nickel mass of about a tenth of a solar mass. You cannot go much below. Although if you look on the density and structure as a function of mass and Chandrasekhar mass, then you need the velocity structures, and the density structures are almost the same. Simply, you gain very little energy from silicon to iron burning, and so the explosion energies are pretty much a constant in this kind of models. This brings us to the brightness decline relation. I want to go here. The opacity, if you are hot, this is here the opacity relatively to Thomson or the extinction as a function of wavelengths between 0 and 20,000 angstroms. And you see, if you are hot, then basically most of the emissivity comes in the UV, where you have also a very strong blocking, therefore the factor is close to 1. In the optical, you have very little lines, so the lines only contribute half of the luminosities, and the opacity swings very much. And if you look for the average opacity at high temperatures above 20,000 degrees, you have opacities of 0.15 or 0.2, depending on the expansion rate, and then it drops relatively rapidly over two orders of magnitude. And this means as soon as you get cool, the envelope becomes transparent. And that's really one of the bases of the brightness decline relation. If we have here the brightness, again, independent from models here shown by different different explosion models, mergers, deflagrations, detonations, mainly depends on the amount of nickel which we produce. If we have produced little nickel, this means if we are dim, then we heat the photosphere very little. This means we become cool very fast. Therefore, we are very red. If we have a lot of nickel, we heat the photosphere very much, and so therefore we are very blue at maximum light. Now, then we can already see what happens. If you are cool, then basically the photosphere recedes very fast in this expanding envelope, and we release the stored energy by former nickel decay very rapidly. And so we have a very fast brightness decline. If we are bright, then we have a relatively slow brightness decline. But what you also see, these are just observations for comparison, and that's just the line, not a fit. basically, if we, for comparison, if we just change the transition density in this particular set of models. What you also see, you also expect a very widespread around the brightness decline relation of, roughly speaking here, almost, you can go here, a magnitude or so, which is much larger than observed. So we need some additional ingredients to get this brightness decline relation better defined. This means 2/10 of a magnitude. How you can do it, it's again this point, DDT models. The main of the spread comes that you have a very different explosion energies because you only burn parts of this. In a DDT model, you basically burn always the same amount of, it means the entire star. This means you have also a constant of the constant of the energies. You again get here the brightness according to the nickel mass, which mainly is determined by the transition density. This means as earlier the transition is, as more nickel we produce, as brighter we are. Supernova, which are dimmer, really have less nickel and therefore are dimmer. And here you have the brightness decline relation, which edges out at the minimum nickel mass. And that's pretty much whether you observe the minimum in the type 1As. Because you could observe dimmer ones, not as a selection effect, but you don't observe dimmer ones. So this becomes pretty consistent. What you also see is you are very flat in the outer layers, and you can do it in a similar way.
I missed your earlier.
Basically, that's the physics which I talked, which we don't really know. So how this is done in this model, we just mix artificially and then we increase the burning rate. We don't, and it could be a statistical parameter by fluctuations.
Okay, so this is a transition where you turn over from the
deflagration to a detonation, basically. Sorry. and then you can produce it. Now, this kind of models are relatively successful already in the middle of the 90s to produce BVRI light curves, not so bad, and even the spectra, here observation versus things, give more or less the right thing. Here it's a little bit small. The problem is optical spectra really have a lot of lines in silicon, sulfur, and so, and iron, but you can hardly measure the outer layers. As you have no oxygen lines, no carbon lines. So we don't really know, didn't know the amount of carbon oxygen which remained unburned. And this really widened. You could have W7 or any of the other models. We didn't have this point. Fortunately, in the last 1 or 2 years, it became better because infrared spectrometer became on. Here again, to show the brightness, we have this region here very well mapped, but this could also be by some sort of deflagration model like W7. Which is, by the way, a spherical model, therefore has more the characteristic of a detonation, but that's another issue. But we couldn't map these outer layers. Fortunately, in the infrared, and here the first observation was really done by Peter Meikle, never published, so to speak, or very late, 5 years later or 6 years later. And here you saw a magnesium line in the near infrared. And if you take the magnesium line, that's basically here this magnesium, which will produce an explosive carbon burning without oxygen burning. And the photosphere recedes already at maximum light to these layers. What this means basically, you see for a very long time this inner edge of the magnesium, therefore this constant velocity, which has been also observed. Another alternative would be a helium line. We will come to this in a minute. The other issue is if you decrease further, then you see here very strong iron lines in these inner layers, which typically should come up here, the theoretical models, a week to 2 weeks after maximum. And 96G was observed, and this was a blind test where we have the model given to some third person, 7-14 days. The observation was at 10 days, and this really was somewhere in between. Now, Howie Marion did a lot of work now recently to really have a snapshot measured with a lot of supernova. And indeed, we always saw this magnesium velocity very nicely. And we saw this infrared iron lines coming up a week after maximum. These are different times, up to maximum and after maximum from top to bottom. We don't see any helium line at 2 micron, so which also would should come with a 1 micron line. And we see other magnesium lines like here and here. So the magnesium identification is not just based on one line, but really on several multiplets. So this made it much more secure.
Can I ask, is there any, at late times,
yes,
do you ever start seeing any molecular lines?
No, unfortunately not. The CO formation only would be possible because of the formation timescales in very subluminous ones.
I'm curious about getting isotopes.
Yeah, this I would be also very curious. The answer is CO could be formed in very subluminous ones, wasn't unfortunately observed at this late times at this wavelength. It's just too dim. But technology with 10-meter class telescopes is now would be in principle possible. But for normal bright, you wouldn't expect it because it's too hot. And then the density is too low. Subluminous was no good instrument at this moment. If you just plot here the magnesium velocities for different supernovas, for different phases, you see first a certain spread. So not all supernova are the same. But what you also see, you have velocities of 14,000. Typically, in this one supernova, you go down to 12,000. Ricci has seen a minimum velocity from 90,000 in another object. Now, you can translate when does the inner edge here go to which velocity, and you can go into this curves with expansion velocity, and then you can ask how much unburned material can you allow to be consistent with this? And then you see upper limits of a 10 solar mass, maybe in one case here up to 2 tenths of a solar mass, but not more. New observations where we see the wings, we can also see here not just this inner edge, but also this wings. And this puts a limit to 10 to minus 2 solar masses for the supernova which have been observed for unburned material.
Well, unburned material, you mean carbon oxygen?
It means carbon oxygen from the white dwarf which hasn't been processed by the nuclear burning. So it seems to be that really we need this burning. A good part was that Chris Gerardi observed a very subluminous supernova now with the infrared and really get a very nice time-dependent spectra which we analyzed and which really gave a little bit about the nature of the subluminous one. Because I remind you, still there may be that the subluminous was Subchandrasekhar mass models or something very different from the normal ones. So what we did, we just selected a model which gives the right brightness decline relation which we have observed, which has been observed here. We just picked the model and say that's a typical white dwarf with the same central density and so on. And then we know the distance for this host galaxy, so we could just plot the absolute brightness or the parent brightness distance our models in. And just remind you, a normal supernova would be here 2 magnitudes above this lines, and they are pretty much smack on with some differences of 2 tenths of a magnitude or so. But they basically go the 3 magnitudes right, have this right brightness decline relation by definition. But they seem to be doing pretty much. What's more impressive, if you look on Chris Gerardi's infrared observed spectra, what you see here is a flux relatively normalized to some wavelengths, I think 12,000 angstroms. The blue one is the observations. The red one is the model at a certain time, and in this time it was something like maximum light or maximum light. You see here indeed the magnesium lines, the silicon line, sulfur line, and in the subluminous supernova you have about a tenth of a solar mass unburned carbon oxygen left, as you may remember. So indeed we see here a carbon line, we see here the oxygen line. What's nice, if you look for the time evolution, you basically scan through the structure. That's a chemical structure normalized to one with a different element. That's the location of the photosphere. So you basically, if you have a time evolution, you can see just where the photosphere and does this, which layers do you form, and is this layer structure consistent with the observations? And this is without any fine tuning. That's a model here, which here's the time at 9 days after the explosion. And 11 days, it means 4 days before maximum, this spectrum you have just seen, it was 4 days before maximum. You see indeed this magnesium layers, and you form really the spectrum in this layer. At maximum light, where you typically see already the nickel velocity, here you still are full in the layers where you have only explosive carbon burning, all these elements, and even the Doppler shift works pretty much. A week after maximum, here you enter the silicon sulfur layers. And so sure enough, a sulfur line comes up, you see some carbon calcium lines, here calcium 2 lines, relatively strong, still not this infrared lines, by far infrared lines by the iron. And only 2 weeks after maximum, you really see then this iron lines really coming up very strong, and this fits almost pretty well, I would say. So the point is, this layered structure works very well. We see the maximum velocity only to up to 4,000 kilometers of this iron layers, and we have really scanned this magnesium distribution, and we could see carbon if it would be really there, which we typically don't see. So everyone would be happy if you wouldn't believe, if you wouldn't remember the 3D deflagration models, because as I mentioned, deflagration during the deflagration, the real deflagration model, the pre-expansion is the same, but you would have nickel blobs up in this way up to 8,000 kilometers. And it should be the same in normal and in subchandrasekhar, in the subluminous model. There's no good reason. So what would happen if you mix? Just take here normal model a week after maximum, and just do the mixing up to 8,000 kilometers. And then you see the spectrum really becomes awful. This means, first of all, due to this radioactive material in the silicon layers, you suddenly excite silicon and sulfur very strongly. You have very strong lines which you don't observe. You see here some iron lines coming up which shouldn't be there, so it just doesn't work. So the question is, don't we have a deflagration phase? Maybe we really have the pre-expansion and smoldering phase. And certainly the question is, what is about rotation? And indeed, for this supernova by accident, we also had a polarization spectrum done in the polarization program, PhD program of Andy Howell. Here you see now the blue one is the observed polarization, the black one is the smoothed one, and the underlying things are just different model, same models, but with different inclinations. And you can indeed reproduce here this dips and this overall spectrum. Just remember that here the spread is already 0.2 or so percent of a polarization in the observation. You can reproduce this polarization relatively well by this model. This part is probably here to short wavelength. We didn't have photon counts in the observations, but so this basically really works very well. You need to see this at about 17% asymmetry in the density and equator on, and the polarization angle basically doesn't change over the radius, so we have a well-defined axis. So it may have to do with the rotation. Just for comparison, in normal supernova, polarization is less, or is measured now with VLT, to about a tenth of a magnitude, so much smaller. So this means really one of the keys for this transition density is maybe really rotation, and may really affect the preconditioning in this phase. Now, if you do, but overall this is relatively small, you do the cosmology, you can do a lot of analysis, then you get the Hubble constant for free, and this we did 64 and 66 with Alexei Kokhlov and Ewald Müller. So we got a Hubble constant of 67 plus minus 8 on the 95% level. The errors were not Gaussian, they are, due to the models, pretty much box-like structures. But so this is pretty much the value where we are also today. So independent from delta C fields, which is not a better determination, but an independent determination, and therefore should give you some confidence. More important is now, what is about evolutionary effects if we go back with redshifts? What we would expect that objects with a shorter evolutionary time, this means from the higher mass limit of the potential progenitors, are more likely because they can really, objects at 1.5 solar masses cannot evolve away from the main sequence. So what we did in an old study is just change the C to O ratio from 1, which was a classical value, to 2/3, and change the metallicity. Now, if you do the explosion, if you change the carbon to oxygen, you basically, and if you burn the entire white dwarf, you change the energetics, so you expand a little bit slower. What this means, you have to wait a little bit longer for the to get the transition density. And what this means, if you look for the nickel distribution, you just produce a little bit less nickel because of the higher pre-expansion, and you by 2/10 of a magnitude, roughly speaking, overall the structure is very much the same. If you change the metallicity, overall the nickel abundance changes by only 5% in this case, but overall the structures are extremely similar, simply because they don't, the other elements don't really go to the energetics. However, metallicity enters, and this means in if you are in the inner layers, you have electron capture during the explosion, but in the outer layers, you basically inherent this metallicity or the YE, electron to proton capture, from the progenitor when the progenitor was formed. Because just to remind you, you have to the YE is basically produced by massive progenitors before this, from which stars formed by the N14 alpha gamma fluor 18 beta plus oxygen 16 neon 22 abundance. So this is really coming from the initial thing, and what this really does, it shifts the balance between in the intermediate state from producing nickel 56 in this outer layers to iron 54. And because it's really a burning product, it's not really the, that you can scale the initial metallicity. You have this amplification effect, and by changing the metallicity by a factor of 3, you almost change the abundance of the iron 54, which is a dominant thing, by a factor of 10 in the outer layers. So, and this indeed shows up in the spectra, not in the light curves. In the light curves itself, it's really only when the energetics, this means the CO ratio changes, that you have a slower rise and a faster decline. Mm-hmm. And basically this results, because they are similar bright, in the offset of the brightness decline relation by about a tenth of a magnitude by times the change in the rise time, so a measurable quantity. You will see this was measured. The CO ratio gives you a little bit different Doppler shift in the spectra, but overall not a big difference. However, it blocks the U color pretty efficiently. And this is the reason why the K corrections are very metal dependent, which you do if you go to higher redshifts with the fixed filters. And that's one of the problems which probably are limiting.
But that limits it. That's just from the iron to nickel trend. I mean, the fact that the neutron rich neon is making iron poor, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay. So is that the dominant metallicity effect?
That is.
For the spectrum? It's really the presence or absence of the neon in the outer part.
Yes. But the things are a little bit more complicated because you cannot just change this because you have also, that's a stellar evolution, or better, the size of the convective core during the stellar evolution, during the helium burning, also, which determines you the change of the CO in the central region from which the white dwarf is formed, is also affected by the metallicity. So it's not just the C2O ratio changes also by the mass independently from this, but you have also, even for the same mass, you have a metallicity effect because you change the size of this inner core where you have less carbon relatively to different metallicity. That's here solar, and it's about a fifth of solar here in this case. And what this does to the light curves, it again changes the rise time, but the brightest decline relation. And because it's energetic, it again gives you the same relation, basically, delta M to is 0.1 times the change in the rise time. So in principle, by distributing this. We did a little bit more parameter study, basically, where we did all the stars between 0 and solar metallicities and 1.5 to 7 solar masses as a progenitor. And what you see here, if you change the mass from 1.5 to 7 solar mass progenitors at the main sequence, you basically get very similar tails because the nickel is relatively similar, but you basically change the peaks here quite a bit because of the kinetics in the early phase. And so you change the peak to tail ratio. And recently, and by 2/10 of a magnitude, and this has been really observed, but may really be able to get a hands on this as a diagnostics. Again, metallicity itself doesn't change you too much in this part. And if you conclude this, the change of the maximum brightness at light, if you change the mass for the same solar metallicity, V minus V basically stays unchanged, and you really change the absolute brightness. So that means this would be an offset in the brightness decline relation of about 0.15. Whereas the metallicity changes you basically B minus V, but not so much the absolute brightness if you have here different metallicities. The problem is it's only 0.05 of a magnitude, but if you not attribute the 0.05 of a magnitude to a reddening, you have to multiply it by 3. So again, you run against something like a wall at 0.15 magnitudes. So the other thing is, do we have current limits? Yes. Rees et al. Gave basically for the local group a rise time to decline relation here like this one. And Aldering gave the same thing for high redshift supernova at 0.5 to 0.7. And you see that the rise times are in the order of a day or smaller, the differences between rise time and decline. And this means at least to this intermediate mass redshifts, the effect is evolutionary effects are less than a tenth of a magnitude, so we really live with omega lambda. It's not big surprise anymore, but this means evolutionary effects itself cannot really argue lambda away. Nice, but you again are stuck on the limit of a tenth of a magnitude, and you can really summarize and different physical effects. You can play around and can ask what is the metallicity doing, what is the effect on the spectra on light curves, and what would be the size of the effect. And what you see here, for instance, there's a degeneracy between the peak brightness to decline ratio, between CO ratio and the change of the central density. It means basically due to the fact that you have a larger region of electron capture, and it has the same effect delta M in the rise time decline relation, but it has a different effect on the silicon velocity, which you would observe at maximum light. So in this kind of things, you may get to improve it. I'm a little bit skeptical that you can get to a few hundredths of a percent, but I think a tenth of a magnitude you probably will get. The rest is really, then you have really this cross terms all over the place. Let me come to the main conclusion of the type 1a. I think they are really thermonuclear explosions. They clearly show a chemical layered structure. This means we have clearly evidence for signature of a detonation. Whether it was whether deflagration is wiped out or not, it's an open question. We have no detection of hydrogen or helium at high metallicities. We have almost the entire white dwarf seems to be burned, at least in the cases where we observed. This means which is now 12, 15 supernova, plus some in literature, so typically maybe two dozen or so. Brightness decline relation can be understood as an opacity effect. All models would give this, or basically all models would give this opacity effect, but you need this additional kinetic energy to make the brightness decline relation sufficiently small. Generally, polarization is relatively small, 0.2%, with the exception of the subluminous one. This really shows you that the accretion and the rotation may really be a critical thing for explaining or understanding the spread and what really triggers this sort of burning front properties. Again, preconditioning is really very important. Delayed detonations can really explain most of the things. The problem is really, at least in the subluminous, in the normal ones, we wouldn't see the signature of a deflagration or very little. In the subluminous one, we should have seen this, but there is no evidence, or more, there's contrary evidence. So we really don't know what's going on. Again, rotation or the smoldering phase, it means the quiet burning phase in the pre-expansion. Maybe a thing. Mergers are indeed very promising, but they are not very likely the main mechanism because they always would expect something like unburned material from the non-eaten up accretion disk around or basically the remains. But some of the objects indeed show this effect pretty clearly. And one problem is really, one really needs to observe the infrared to recognize whether it's a merger or DDT. If you go back in time, mergers may take over, for instance, and without noticing, but they don't really have the same brightness decline relation than this kind of models. Deflagrations, at least in the current things, have problems basically with most of these things. They don't show a layered structure. They have a lot of unburned material and so on. But maybe deflagrations, if we study the nonlinear phase of instabilities, may change it, but that's the current state. Distance indicators, Hubble constant is pretty much the same, which one gets with the delta CVs. We, in principle, allow spectra and light curves to detect evolutionary effects, and it's clear we can improve the accuracy from 2/10 of a magnitude, maybe by a factor of 2 or 3. Beyond this, it's a question of optimism, which you have. Maybe yes, maybe no. For high-precision cosmology, we would really like to have 1 to 2%, which is a pretty far way to go, but it may be possible. But secondary parameters are mandatory.
Well, before you go on, I don't understand point three. What does detection of hydrogen have to do with all this at all?
Oh, in the Schapp-Chandra-Seca Schapp-Chandra-Seca mass models, they are triggered by an ignition of helium in the outer layers. And the point was, this magnesium line at 1.05 has also a corresponding helium line. And the question was, maybe that's an indication for a remains of a strong helium layer at the outer layers, and the iron we can get rid some way. We don't know why. But then you would also see a 2-micron line, and the infrared would have seen this. The other thing is, we accrete hydrogen on the outer layers, and we have 0.10⁻³ or 10⁻⁴ solar mass of hydrogen at the time of the explosion, which we potentially may see or not. So this basically says we may get a grid in the future, whether we have hydrogen accretors or carbon oxygen accretors or helium accretors, but not quite yet. This brings me a little bit to the future perspectives, and here it's a little bit wish lists and speculations. One thing which we really will get is a new generation of instruments. VLT really allows now very good measurements of polarization, and we have an ongoing project. Gemini is very nice. What may be surprising here, SWIFT is very extremely nice, because what you do, what we are looking at is, if you run through this white dwarf, and we have surface burning, if you have a lot of hydrogen in the outer layers, we can basically produce X-rays. And they look pretty much like one spike, maybe. So it may be that SWIFT will be triggered also by some supernova. And then we have light curves not from -5 magnitudes before maximum, but just from a second after the explosion. There's a real chance that SWIFT will get this as a byproduct. SNAP, ZERTIF, and NGST, just to mention. intermediate redshift service like Supernova Factory, Essence, are really critical. We must understand more the physics of the progenitors to be really confident that at high redshift we can increase the accuracy sufficient. And we have 3D effects now in the calculations, and they really need a little bit more CPU power. The problems are certainly supernova and their environment. How do we go to the thermonuclear runaway? We just did the first step. How do we do the surface burning of the white dwarf? This means the accretion process, helium flash problem, and so on. 3D nature of the supernova, and in particular, the rotation where this two may be actually connected. And we have nuclear burning in nonlinear regime, different scenarios. And related question is certainly quest for the nature of the dark energies. And I think some topic which really will come up very soon, means in a few years, is supernova have the potential that we can probe the dark ages, because if we go to the infrared for 2 to 3 micron, we would be able to see supernova even before the recombination. And now the map results, which say we have star formation much earlier, means that if we go to a few microns and if we can see supernovas at this, we may have not really something like a reionization of the universe, but we have something like a foam which starts already at a redshift of 20, 30 by gamma ray bursts, by everything. And then really it's what you see at a redshift of 6 as a end of this reionization, maybe just that the foam merges and we lose the walls at this point. Okay, thank you very much.
In 1D,
it's a little bit hard to include. So what we basically are doing at the moment is, first of all, it's pretty hard to construct a stable rotating white dwarf. I think this we have now under control. And then the next step is to really blow the things up in multi-D, which we haven't yet done, but that's underway. The other issue is the surface burning. You have this helium flashes, and one of the ideas is basically if you have different realizations of log G on the surface due to the asymmetry, then you may avoid basically helium flashes, because as soon as you go into the flash, you can go sidewise. So you reduce the sizes of the flashes. But this, I did a little bit analytic models, but this needs much more work really to go. So yes, the next big step is really to look much more on the rotation, to ask the question whether indeed they can do a DDT transition due to shear flows, what is the surface burning. But that's a long program. This will come over the next few years. But definitely rotation seems to be a very important process. Maybe not so surprising, after the fact that we accrete a lot of material from an accretion disk, and so you may expect a lot of angular momentum dumping on this object. And
I mean, you would expect a steep shear profile at the surface of the carbon oxygen?
That's what some of the models predict. And if you have the shear profiles, this was what I mentioned with the DDT transitions. Then you have not a self-driven mixing, but a propelling basically as soon as some blob goes in there. And this layer certainly depends on the initial mass of the white dwarf and all the things. But this is really down the road. We really have to do much more careful work. And that's a program which will come over the next 5 to 10 years, I think, to get it really under control. Numerically, it's extremely hard to do this kind of things, and you do approximations. So we are just with small steps try now to expand this, but
is it even really well determined what the differential rotating profile is?
That's a good question. Norbert Langer did some calculations with a student, and the point is they do spherical stellar evolution models, and they just reduce the effective log G by the equatorial centrifugal force, which is not exactly the right because you have the other height. And what they took into account is basically the propagation of the shear instability. And the predictions which they have is basically you see a differential profile between some of the outer layers of the accreted layers and the inner core, which comes from the star. And what they found is shear flows of about 500 to 1,000 kilometers, which would be plenty for any of this. Whether this really occurs or whether you have then transport by magnetic fields and so on, that's an open question, but who the hell knows? This doesn't mean really, well, no, I mean, okay. it needs further studies.
If you start having rapidly and potentially rotating stars, why should I fix on the Chandrasekhar karma?
Oh, you mean why don't you go very high over Chandrasekhar? It's very
No,
Nomoto basically suggested that he can get with a spherical rotating white dwarf can get any mass and was produced some models with 3 solar mass or 2.5 solar mass. The problem is a little bit centrifugal force you can only have at the equator. At the pole, you still see more or less the entire potential within the radius. So you can increase it by 10% or so, the relatively Chandrasekhar mass. Means you may have a 1.6 or 1.7 solar masses, but it's very hard to see how you really can go well above. And at the current limit, it wouldn't make a difference whether you would go at 1.3 or at 1.5 solar masses if you want to get it earlier, the explosion, basically, at this point. But which is pretty clear from the rise time in the Schapp-Chandrasekhar mass model. You have to keep the photosphere for a very long time in these outer layers. And this gives you basically a minimum of the mass which you have up to this time. And for 99BY, the lower limit is something like 1.2 solar masses. So with this very subluminous supernova, for normal ones, 1.37 or so work well. But it doesn't mean that it must be exactly. But only close to the Chandrasekhar model, you have this automatic ignition process by the adiabatic compression. In the other regimes, you don't have it. So,
let me ask about the iron isotopes. I mean, most iron we see, or half of it, is made this way in type 1.
Yes.
So getting those isotopes right is should be a strong constraint.
Yeah, the point.
But my memory is vague on that. That ends up being a constraint.
Yes.
Density is high, we'll give a lot of electron capture,
right,
and it changes your neutron proton ratio.
Exactly.
So your central densities you're giving are 1 to 3 by 10 to the 9, or 2.
Yeah, 8. 2. Yeah, right.
Are those already? So why not higher densities? Is that because of the iron problem or?
No, the answer is a clear no. In the old electron capture rate, it was really due to this nuclear synthesis argument. Now, unfortunately, the electron capture rate has been changed by a factor of 5 recently, when the people had more better atomic physics. And what this means is limit, which was before 2 times 10 to the 9, or 2.5 for a typical one, can easily go to 3 times 10 to the 9 up in this case. The other problem is certainly this limits which you have is limited on spherical models. Now, as soon as you have, even if you have some deflagration and you have some rising, the effective blobs have a shorter time. So in principle, with 3D, you could allow a little, it doesn't really have a lot of imprint, but for the nuclear synthesis, if you rise to lower densities in the blob, you shorten basically the time which is in the high density regime during burning. And in this case, you may even go to 4 times 10 to the 9. So that's not the limit, which was so hard a few years ago. It became very soft. The main reason why 2 times 10 to the 9 works very well is, well, something a little bit history. But if you really would go consistently with 4 times 10 to the 9, you would run a little bit into the problems in the outer layers. To make the magnesium at the right velocity where you observe it. So, but there's nothing anymore to say there must be something at 2 times 10 to the 9. We cannot have 4 or 5 times 10 to the 9 in a certain amount of cases, and certainly not from the nuclear synthesis anymore.
Thank you again.
Okay. Thank you.